Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. Thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are plenty more conversations about things you're interested in and things you don't know you're interested in yet. Not until you try them anyway. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or to iTunes, where you can get lots more for free.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. Many of us are brought up with the useful instruction that you should take people as you find them. And that idea seems to be a way through for Ian Brown. Ian Brown's a very successful Canadian journalist. He's a feature writer for the Globe and Mail newspaper, and he also presents a TV documentary series over there. Around 14 years ago, Ian Brown's wife gave birth to their second child. It was a son, and they named him Walker. Walker was born with a genetic mutation that's incredibly rare. There's maybe just 100 people in the world with it. He still wears nappies. He more or less operates at the level of a two-year-old. And he has to wear cuffs on his arm so he won't be constantly hitting himself. And often he can only calm down when he's held and sung to. But even so, despite all the distress and exhaustion, Walker is able to bring moments of really profound joy into Ian's life that are so lovely that they're almost mysterious. And Ian calls him my sweet, sweet, lost and broken boy. Ian Brown's book caused a sensation in Canada when it was serialised in the Globe and Mail, and it's called The Boy in the Moon. Ian Brown, welcome to Conversations.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, my wife read this book too, and we actually talked about it quite late into the night last night. After a while, we sort of began to realise that this story is really like, has so much in common with the parenting of a healthy child in infancy. But it goes on, and everything's extreme. I don't know. Is that a fair characterization of your story?
Oh yes, I think so. It's raising Walker is raising an infant is like raising a question mark, and raising Walker is certainly like one. The only difference is that Walker stays an infant intellectually, and so that period is stretched out. But I think it's. You know, people see disabled children and they, you know, we're all afraid of disability. I'm afraid of it. I go into a room of disabled kids even now, you know, and my first reaction is always, you know, the booping and the weeping and the banging and the clacking and the broken bodies. And I think, oh, my God, what am I going to do? How do I fix this? What do I do first? And, you know, you have to realize you can't fix it and you have to let them be. But you do get into this zone with Walker where you realize that he is like every other kid. It's just more intensive and it reminds you again and again of what it's like.
Yeah, an infant, you've always got to stop them accidentally hurting themselves like you do with Walker, but he's bigger and stronger and he can't move on. He can't really move on. And that's sort of kept you and your wife, or it did for a long while, in this state, I suppose, protracted infancy with a child.
Yes, and not just protracted infancy, but protracted mystery, because it's a very rare syndrome. There are now, I think, 135 people who may have it. And those have been discovered over the internet, and with people not having to travel, not having to see the actual case. They've located about 135. And what happens is that no one knew anything when he was born. The syndrome was only named in 1979. When he was born, there were 8 cases. By the time he was 2, there were 20 known cases. And they're very, very rare. None of the doctors knew anything about it. And so we spent 2 years trying to figure out if he was normal or not, why he couldn't swallow, why he couldn't put on any weight, whether he could see, whether he could hear, why he couldn't learn to walk properly, which he eventually did. It was 2 years before we knew that he had this thing called CFC.
Is the condition? Yes, and it's called CFC, but what is it? What does it, and what does it mean?
It's just a mash of symptoms, really. It stands for cardiofaciocutaneous syndrome. Cardio pertains to the enlarged or broken or misfiring hearts that these children often, people often have. The CF refers to facio, cardiofacio, which is the dysmorphic face, lowered ears and sort of slightly down slanting eyes, no eyebrows. That is the sort of the giveaway symptom. And cutaneous pertains to his skin, which tends to be very sensitive and a bit bizarre and bumpy.
Were there telltale signs when he was born?
No. Well, he was low on his APGAR scores, and then he needed a bit of oxygen. He wouldn't, within 2 days, he couldn't latch on to feed. He couldn't swallow the milk without aspirating. His eyes bobbed around. His doctor, I must have gone to the pediatrician. I can't remember how many times, 5-10 times a week, for the first 6 months of his life. And As he became more solidly disabled, and there were things wrong, and he would hit himself, or he would start to cry. It was I always remember going into the doctor. We had an office. He had an office in the north of Toronto, which is a very well off area, and he's a very good pediatrician. Wore a tie, and there were a lot of quite well off mothers, and their children would come in, for a cold or to fix something that had gone wrong, and I think they kind of liked the doctor. They'd sort of dress up, and flirt with him a bit. And I remember coming in with Walker. And it was very quiet, very well-behaved. And walking into the waiting room with Walker, who was, hitting himself and screaming and looked weird. And there's me with, 17 different bags on my shoulders. It was like walking into the sort of like a one-man band, with some firecrackers under my armpits firing off, singing, yes, we have no bananas. Everybody was very nice, but it's a different experience having one of these kids.
I've seen footage on the Globe and Mail's website of Walker hitting himself, and it's really, really distressing, and I can only think of what it's like to see it as a parent.
Yeah, I couldn't stand it.
Yeah. Why? You can't really know, I suppose, but why do you suspect he hits himself?
It's interesting that medicine's, says, well, we've got to find the answer to that. But as a parent, you speculate, and you have different speculations at different times. I have, at various stages, thought that he hits himself because he wants to talk but cannot, because he knows, he's aware that other people can do things he can't do. And he's frustrated by that. There is a theory that he does it to stimulate himself, to make some brain activity that he feels in his body as satisfying. There are many possibilities. The interesting thing is, for me, as sort of an observer, I'm a professional observer, a reporter by trade, but all of those things could be true. And I found that having multiple answers is actually more satisfying than just having one scientific solution.
It's like when babies cry. Parents say, well, the baby's got colic. And what does that mean? It could be anything.
That's the universal answer, isn't it?
She's tired, she's hungry, or whatever. And you project all these reasons on because you need an explanation. But there's none forthcoming, really.
No.
And you have to just live with that after a while.
You have to live with it or speculate. I remember talking to a geneticist once, asking him if I would ever be able to fix Walker's brain. And I've been to a lot of these medical professionals, and he was a brilliant guy. And he said, the brain, I said, could we fix it? Could we redirect a couple of wires? Could we take a bit out or put something else in? And he said, the brain has over a billion axons. Each one has 1,000 inputs going into it and 10,000 coming out. He said, we'll never understand the brain. Even people like me, these experts, this doctor said, in 200 years, he said, to understand the brain will be like being an astronomer, lying on your back, looking up into the darkness. You see all these lights. Maybe you have a lens that brings them a little closer, but mostly it's speculation. And I think
Did you say, though, well, that's beaut, but I've still got a kid who's hitting himself. I mean, what can you do to help me, doctor?
Well, yeah, that is the problem. I mean, I did say, what can you do to help me? And I often became frustrated with the doctors. You know, they've saved these children, right? These children did not exist 30 years ago. They didn't survive. Medical technology allows them to live. But then it says, right, he's your problem now. And you have to do the daily work. And the society doesn't really, you know, because this population of people didn't exist before, we have no system to take care of them. So it falls upon the parents. So yes, it was a bit frustrating.
Ian, once you brought Walker home and his condition became more obvious over time, tell me about the impact that had on you and your wife and your daughter too. You have an older daughter, Hayley, mm-hmm. who's perfectly healthy. How did that start to change family life?
It was a nightmare. I mean, it was like standing, suddenly, it was like walking along in a beautiful place where you could see for miles and suddenly coming up to the edge of a chasm. Think, oh my God, I could fall into it. And it was a bottomless hole. It really, he doesn't sleep through the night. So my wife and I would switch off alternate nights. So neither of us slept two nights in a row for about 10 years. Because he was upstairs in a room next to Haley's. Haley's my daughter. She was a little girl when he was born. One of us would have to sleep with up in Haley's room so we could be near his room when he woke up, because then you'd have to get him up, disconnect him from his pump. The procedure is, you know, 10 minutes in the dark, so he wouldn't change him probably in the dark while he's hitting himself at the same time, keeping all that stuff. It's like being James Bond, you know, trying to defuse an atomic bomb or something. Take him downstairs, bring him back up. So Haley's sleeping down with her mother. We were like a sort of bedroom Bedouins, you know, the whole, and that's just the sleeping aspect of it. You know, there was the neurologist, the eye doctor, the ear doctor, the skin doctor, the constant. It just, you know, I was a fairly callow guy, even more callow, you know, than I am now. When I began this, and I saw my life end, my wife's life end, my daughter's life diminished, all for the sake of this little boy whose life I wasn't sure. I mean, I didn't know what the value of it was. I mean, never mind figuring out what he had and how to keep him alive. The bigger problem for me was, what does his life mean? What is the value of it? Because he doesn't seem to have a great deal of value to me. And, you know, there was a famous case in Canada, Robert Latimer, who had a daughter. He lived in Saskatchewan as a farmer, where there really were no services, no respite, no nothing. And he asphyxiated her. He went to jail. He said it was a mercy killing. He did not apologize. I don't condone that. I would never do that.
But it makes you think, though.
Many was the night when Walker would have maybe fallen off to sleep. I'd be awake. I'd go out into my backyard of my little house and have a cigarette. And I'm not proud of this, but many nights I did contemplate, think, I thought, how can I, maybe I should take him out with me. I mean, I don't want to get rid of him without, but maybe if both of us went for a walk and something happened, or I could go up into the, I do a lot of ski mountaineering when I can, and, you know, I get my gear, and my skis and my skins and my pack and my rope and my ice axe, and I'll get him and his nappies and the medicine bag, which I'll need for a couple of days anyway, and the, you know, van load of paraphernalia that you take everywhere you go. And I'll go up into the mountains, which is a 4-hour plane ride away, and we'll lie down in a snowbank. But then I thought, but I'll have to go through security at the airport. And I thought, well, Christ, if I can get through that, I can get through anything, you know. It was pretty dark, I must say. But, you know, I didn't want to write a book of complaining, because complaining doesn't do anything. The interesting thing about it was in this darkness, there were these, and I'm not being a Pollyanna about this. I mean, I despise these, misery. What do you have a word for them in Australia? I think you call them
misery memoir.
Misery books about disability that say, you know, these are special children given to special parents by a special God. You know, I mean, if I don't believe myself, but if Walker is God's idea of a gift, of some sort of specialness, God, you know, needs to read an etiquette book, because a bottle of wine would have been fine. So I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna, but in this darkness, there were also these to me, unbelievable moments of grace that seemed, it took me a book to figure out why they were important, and I'm not even sure I have now, but they were moments that made me think, you know, there is something here that is much, much, much bigger, much, much more valuable. And in the equation of the darkness of his life, and you know, people used to say, "Would you change Walker to Johanna?" And you hear parents of disabled kids say all the time, "Well, I would never change my child. I'd keep him exactly as he is the rest of the time." Well, I think that's unfair to Walker for one thing. I mean, his life is very different. But Johanna said, "Of course, I'd change him. You know, for the most average child, not for my sake, not for her sake, but for Walker's sake." But there, despite that darkness, there was this other side of the equation, which was
grace. Grace. Grace is a really interesting word.
I think.
It's not quite. Yeah. It's different from joy.
Yeah, very much so.
In what way can you talk about that? Because that's really important, I think. What you think that means? Grace is a really interesting word to use in this context, because it's not like a ride at the fun fair, is it? It's a different thing.
Hmm. Can I give you an example? During the night, when he would wake up and cry and hit himself, and I couldn't bear it, so I'd have to get him a bottle and feed him the bottle and hope he would go back to sleep and give him another dose of chloral hydrate, and that meant disconnecting him from the pump and, you know, this 20-minute routine. And it often didn't work. But when it did work, and I would take him back to the bed and realize I'd forgotten the pump, and I'd have to, by now we're in Haley's bed, you know, my bed with him, so he's in my arms, so he'll fall asleep. And I'm lying there with one hand behind his head so I can hold his left hand so he won't hit himself, and his right hand in my bigger right hand so he won't hit himself, and my legs across his legs because he'll hit himself if you stop his hands, kick himself. If it worked and he went to sleep, I could always tell because he'd put both his hands on his bottle, stroke the bottle a bit, he'd turn on his side, and he'd sort of jam his bony little, you know, backside into my hip, and he would fall asleep, and I would sort of hurry after him. And for all the, I don't want to overdo it, but sometimes agony of that, at that moment, you know, I loved it. I loved that moment because it felt like I was just an ordinary father of an ordinary little boy. And sometimes I think, you know, that is his gift to me, to let me feel that, except that he parcels it out and gives it to me only rarely. And as a result of that, the gift is that I get to see how important it is, how valuable it is, how if you know, Haley, who is 17, Walker's 14 now, Haley is 17, she is everything Walker is not, bright, articulate, graceful, beautiful. I mean, you know, she's my daughter, so, you know,
she's your daughter.
Yeah, she's my daughter. But she'll come in, and she's a very good dancer. You know, she studied amateur ballet for a bit, and so she'll dance with him for 20 seconds. And, she, you know, she's his favorite. I mean, she's his hero. Yes, she is his hero. And he's on top of the world. You know, in a normal life, it's in passing. Or when she reads him a book. And I have a photograph of this. I put some photographs in the book because it's very hard to take a photograph of Walker.
Why?
Because he looks, I think, when you look at the photo, he looks worse than he is. You see none of his personality. You see only the misshapen, bulbousness of his head, say, or his heavy jaw, or his stumpy, you know, sort of lamb chop-like hands. Not disfigured, but not normal.
You miss what you call his cocktail party personality.
Yeah,
I think it's a lovely phrase.
Yeah, yeah, and he has a cocktail party, and that's actually a medical phrase to describe children. But he's, you know, I have put this photograph in the book because it, and I have it on my desk to remind me of why I write, or try to write. It's a picture of him, of Haley and him reading. And they're lying on their backs, you know, the way kids do, right? And Haley's holding the book up above them, and Walker's next to her. And she's reading, and he is, I don't think he understands a single word. But he is so there. Man, he is in that moment, and he's so happy because this incredible ancient ritual, his lovely, beautiful sister is bestowing attention on him. She has this weird contraption, this thing called it's called a book, but it is a book. It's got pictures and it's got words. And she is chanting aloud in written language, in language arranged to be a chant that speaks to people. She is reading this to him. And he may not understand those words, but I think if you look, you know, get the book, you see the picture.
He looks engaged.
He looks like he understands how hallowed, you know, that ritual, human ritual, never mind for a disabled kid, for all of us can be. You know, and I see that and I think that really is important. And maybe it is worth sitting in front of a typewriter and banging out a few words for it.
Ian Brown is my guest in conversation. He's a Canadian journalist, a senior features writer for the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto. He also presents TV documentaries and Canadian television. Around 14 years ago, his second child was born. It was a son called Walker with an impossibly rare genetic mutation, abnormality called
cardiofaciocutaneous syndrome.
Thank you, Ian. And Ian's written a memoir of what that's been like to live with this his son for all these years. It's called The Boy in the Moon. Give me a sense of what Walker can actually do, what level he's at, how he communicates and gets about.
He's mobile. He can walk. And he's 14. He looks 9. And operates at, you know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years old. So he's not rational. He'll get himself into trouble. You know, he'll open a hot oven. He'll, stick his hand in something bad. I remember coming up once, we were at dinner, and he learns hardly anything ever, but suddenly he picks things up. I remember we were having dinner once with some friends, and in those days he used to play around the bottom of the stairs because I think it let him lie down and stand up at the same time. It wasn't quite so tiring for him, and he couldn't open a door, and I knew that he was safe there. So we were all eating dinner. I heard this noise. I thought, "What is that?" It's like a tinkling noise, and I went out, and Walker's gone, and at the top of the stairs, the door is open. And I go up there, and he's let himself into the living room where we were before. And he's taken in his hand the last of 6 crystal wine glasses, which he is just about to smash on this glass Noguchi coffee table. You know, just glass everywhere. And not a cut on him. You know, not a cut. So he's capable of, he liked the noise. He liked the way he loves shiny things. If he were here, he'd be looking at your watch, or he'd love all the lights in front of you. You know, he'd that flashing on air sign. You know, he'd be looking at that. So,
see, when I hear that, I'm always again. I keep thinking of how much it's illustrative in a general sense of what it's like to life before kids and after kids. You bought a glass and a Gucci coffee table. You would never buy that after you have children, of course.
No.
But before you buy this stuff, yeah, and then you have your kid that runs loose smashing crystal wine glasses against it.
Yeah. No, there is that brief period between college when you wouldn't buy university when you wouldn't buy a Noguchi coffee table in there. But, you know, the interesting thing is you see in those habits when I began, I used to think, well, he's smashing wine glasses on the table. That's bad. Another habit he had, if he were here, I have a glass of water in front of me. So I'd be watching him, and he'd be walking around and just going into corners and rut. His most developed sense is in his hands, in touch. So he loves to touch objects over and over again and feel surfaces. He might go over there and touch the wall. He'd touch the sponge on the end of the microphone. But he would eventually come back here. And when my attention was distracted for a second, he'd knock that glass of water off. And then he would burst out laughing. And he used to do this, like every surface in our house, 18 inches in, was cleared off. And I didn't realize, and 11 years later, after he was born, I finally met another kid with CFC. I went into their house, I thought, oh, they've got a CFC kid. Every surface is cleared to 18 inches in. But he would come and he would clear that off. And I used to think, you know, he's a psychopath. That's why he does that. He does it. He bursts out laughing. You know, I'm going to – at 15, he's going to be in the state penitentiary. I'm going to be tapping at him through the plexiglass. But I realized that eventually, having watched him do it 500 times, I thought, why does he laugh when he does it? And he laughs and comes over to me and wants to be held, like cuddles and wants to connect.
Isn't this great? Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. What he's doing is – I think he knows – very clearly that he's less capable, that I can do everything better than him, except once in a while he can prove that he's as smart as me. He can trick me. And, you know, that moment, I mean, I imagine it's a bit of a liberation for him. You know, he goes, I can be as smart as my dad once in a while. But, you know, for me, it is an enormous liberation because I get freed of that business of having, he has to do the right thing. He has to be this way, of measuring him against the standard, you know, chart of what is successful. And he never succeeds on that. But when he can be as smart as me and I can be like him and appreciate that on his level, the liberation for me is enormous because I'm freed of that orthodoxy. And I think that's another moment of grace, you know. And the grace that he gives me is, you know, infinitely greater than any help I give him.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
My guest in conversation is Canadian journalist Ian Brown. His book about his son Walker is called The Boy on the Moon, and it's about Walker, who suffers from an incredibly, almost impossibly rare genetic disorder called CFC, which means that even though he's, 14 years old or thereabouts now, he remains pretty much at the level of a child who's 1.5 to 2 years old. For years and years, Ian and his wife cared for Walker as best they could. It's the story really of the kind of things you think under these circumstances of what can only be described as extreme parenting. Is there a test available for CFC?
No, it's too. The genetics of it are still very experimental. They're not certain. It would be prohibitively expensive, and you probably couldn't catch it anyway because it occurs in the first couple of hours, they think. It's one random genetic mutation. There are 3 billion pairs of nucleotides. This is the full extent of my scientific understanding of the human body in that phrase. But there are 3 billion pairs of nucleotides. One pair went wrong. And normally in the body, the DNA repairs itself. But in Walker's case, it doesn't. And as a result, the cells send the wrong signals to each other. So we think that maybe part of his brain that should have been in one place is in a little specks or in other places.
And so the wiring's all wrong.
The wiring's wrong, yeah.
Nonetheless, and one of the really interesting things about this book, it's so honest, Ian, is that you and your wife and your thinking and conversations, you entertain all sorts of thoughts that understandably you'd have, but most people would never even imagine having in their lives. And one, of course, was the one you mentioned earlier about having a kind of a strange fantasy where you and Walker would go to the snow and lie down together and die together. Mm-hmm. There was a day when you had a conversation with your wife about what you would have done if you'd known Walker had CFC in utero, whether you would have had an abortion or not. Tell me what happened that day, if you can, if that's not too painful for you, but because it does go to some very interesting places in what it means to be a parent and the guilt you have, all sorts of things. Yeah.
Well, you know, early on, I think when Walker was 5 weeks old and wasn't getting any better, wasn't getting any bigger, wasn't thriving, his pediatrician, I was back for, you know, my umpteenth trip, and I said, I don't know what to do. I mean, it's not his ears, it's not this, it's something else now. And the doctor said, you know, you've got to make sure he eats. You've got to make sure he eats. We do want this child to survive, don't we?
Don't we?
And, I thought, that's a Is that a rhetorical question? Are you chastising me or are you asking me? Because, you know, I had many thoughts like that. I thought, well, if he's sick, perhaps we won't work very hard to get him better. Because if he's really, you know, if his life is going to be lived at in the shadows, in the twilight, you know, in the, at a 10% level of potential, I mean, and it's going to take 80% of everybody else's life away. That means we've lost four lives to care for one uncareable child. You know, maybe we should let him go. That's not a thought you want to have as a father. I mean, it haunts you. And, you know, later my wife and I would talk about, you know, we'd lie awake at night and, you know, on your back looking up into the, you know, the blackness as you do when you're married. And I said, you know, would you have, if you had had a test, if there had been a test for Walker, would you have had an abortion? Would you have gotten rid of him? And she said, well, you know, that's not a fair question. And I must say that as she was answering these questions, you know, I could sense the anxiety in her voice, because for her, these are complex questions. You know, she's not an idiot by any stretch, a very caring and engaged woman. But she said, yeah, it's not a fair question. You can't ask me now whether I would have gotten rid of Walker, because Walker is a story now. And I don't mean a story in a book. I mean, he's a story in our lives. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. He's a thing. He's a being. You know, he's him. He has a person. It may not be a personality that's on the chart anywhere, but he's very much a person. So you can't say to me now, would I have gotten rid of him? But she said, if I could have, before he became a story, before he became a knowable being, instantaneously, yes, she would have changed him.
Parents, you've discovered, of children with this condition, nearly all of them feel guilty.
Mm.
Why?
You know, that goes back. I mean, Herodotus wrote about that. Aristotle writes about it, about this, the whether the parent is responsible. Even today, you know, once a month, a woman will come up to me, generally a younger woman who's going to have a baby and is worried about having a baby. And she'll look at me and she'll know about Walker. And, you know, I can see her looking at me going, well, are there any telltale signs? Like, can I see that he could be the progenitor of a damaged, a disabled kid? I can actually see them looking. So, does he have weird ears, or then, like, does he have double knuckles or something like that? And I'm used to it at this point. And then they see that, you know, I'm at least moderately average.
You're a fine figure of manhood. May I make that observation, sir?
Yeah, but
and your wife's a very attractive woman.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yes.
But you know, you can see her getting more anxious. But once a month, somebody says to me, "Is it because you know you were over 40? Is that what caused Walker? In other words, did you cause Walker? What is the cause?" But Walker is random. He is that thing we fear. He is the result of the random, unpredictable occurrence.
So, but if you know that's nonsense, why do you believe? Why do you?
Well, it's a theory in science at the moment. Just as you know, it used to be a theory of scientists that autism was caused by uncaring mothers. You know, we're afraid of it. We're afraid of the disabled because we don't know how to fix it. It makes us think we're going to spend all our lives looking after it. We're never going to have any pleasure again. It defeats our sense of order. But Jean Vanier, a great leader of the disabled, he thinks that when you see a disabled person, you see your own disability. You see the prospect of your own demise, and that's why, and it's unavoidable. You can't shake it away. They won't go away. They can't fix the face, and you can't pretend we survive.
Going out in public with Walker is an interesting experience. There's moments here. I think from what you've gone through, it gives you this really penetrating insight. I'm just going to quote you here about going out in public or going to a I think it's a baseball game or something like that with Walker. You say the worst are teenage girls. You say the staring used to bother me. The worst offenders were teenage girls who can't stop both hoping and fearing the entire world is gazing at them in rapture. Girls who want to stand out and fit in at the same time. A duplicitous transaction. Walker doesn't allow the two of us. Wow. Boy, you hit that nail on the head, didn't you, I think?
Yeah, I hope so.
What do they do? What do they won't push you when they giggle or something.
Yeah, it was. It's so vivid in my mind. I remember three of them. You know, they all hang around in packs of three, right? There's two short ones and a tall one, and it's that's the standard configuration. and they're all wearing the same thing.
Yeah.
They're all wearing a pop top and a little short skirt and some flip flops. They've all got exactly the same hair, exactly the same beret, exactly the same wristband, exactly the same is what they are. And then they see the different thing, the other. You know, this, you know, they see, you know, Quasimodo and his handler, you know, coming towards them in the stroller. And you, the tall one, the leader, you can see her leaning over to her friend and putting her hand up and, you know, like this. And the other, they look, and then you, the look of shock and horror. In the beginning, I used to want to say, you know, not only is it impolite to stare, but it's inhuman to behave the way you're behaving. You know, this is just another a less fortunate version of you. And you might have some parallel to, you know, you can't talk to, you should never talk to somebody that way. But I've learned to
not care. You just don't care anymore, do you? You're really quite happy. You don't really care if Walker makes a noise or gurgles or whatever. If you're having a good time, too bad. Isn't that your attitude now?
As you say that, I realized that I picked it up from Walker. You know, he doesn't apologize. He is. Now, when we walk down the street, and he loves to be outside hours and hours and hours. And because he walks slowly, we have not a wheelchair, but a kind of fast moving chair. So I put my elbows on the handles and I lean over, so that my voice is closer to his ear. And we were two sort of boulevardiers. You know, we stroll and I'll say, oh, look, you know, look at this fur coat coming along here. Look, oh, my God, look at that hat. What do you think of that? Oh, look, and, you know, the Hungarian butchery still got the same side of meat in the window. It's been 6 months now. Nobody's going to be eating that, you know. And Walker doesn't understand the words, but he understands the context. It's with his dad, and it doesn't have to be me. I mean, there's many people he, you know, enjoys as much or more. I'm with some, and we're talking. He. It's almost as if he knows what's going on, even though he doesn't know the actual words. He knows this is an. We're engaged. We're both engaged. He's listening, and he laughs. He loves it. He's thrilled to be have somebody whispering secrets in his ear as he goes along.
Ian Brown is a Canadian journalist with the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto. He's also a TV presenter there as well. His book is called The Boy in the Moon, Father's Search for His Disabled Son. He's talking here about his son, Walker, who's now 14 years old, who has a very, very rare genetic condition called CFC, which keeps him more or less at the level of someone who's 18 months to two years old. Now, you mentioned this man, Jean Vanier, earlier. Tell me about Jean Vanier and the community he established.
I stumbled upon him by accident. I'd heard that there were these communities. There were a couple in Toronto. There were two in Montreal. There were 170 all over the world, but there was a 20-year waiting list. You couldn't get in. I had heard it was very Catholic, very religious. That's for some reason, I'm not sure why. I didn't want Walker going to a place where he could be influenced, of course. No, and I admit to a slight irrationality at times. Anyway, I wrote a bit of a story about Walker, and somebody from L'Arche called me and said, you know, you should go and talk to Jean Vanier. He'd like to talk to you. And Vanier is a Canadian himself. He's the son of a former governor general. And he was a professor. He was a philosophy. He did his PhD on friendship in Aristotle. Brilliant lecturer. His mother wanted him to be a priest, but he didn't want to do that. And he was lecturing at the University of Toronto, and he went to France, and he decided to do a little bit of work in an institution in a small town in Picardy, just northeast of Paris. And he went and he found this huge room full of disabled men, intellectually disabled men. And he thought, this is terrible. They're not treated like human beings. So being the sort of eccentric guy he was, he said, well, I'm going to buy a little house. So he bought a little stone house, and he had a little de chevaux, you know, la poubelle, the garbage can, those little crappy Peugeots.
Inspector Clouseau car, that
yeah,
kind of
Inspector,
thing.
Yeah. Exactly, Inspector yeah. Clouseau car. He's a bit like Inspector Clouseau in a way. And he said, I'm going to move in with three of these guys, three grown men, none of whom can speak. Philosophy professor, right? like brainiac guy. I'm going to move in with three mute grown men. And so he did. And I was asking him, I said, well, what did you plan to do? He said, I don't know, we were going to have fun. I said, well, how are you going to do that? He said, I didn't know. I thought we'd drive around in the car a bit. And one of them was too disabled physically for him to care for. But so he was the guy who helped them, you know, get up, got them dressed. They had breakfast, lunch, and dinner together, and they hung around. And I said, well, did you work with them? Did you do therapy? He said, well, we had people who came in and helped them, but that was really, I just wanted to create a community, a house where they were equal to me. Because normally, you know, the way Walker lives in a house three quarters of the time, an assisted living place, and it's a very fine place, but it's very much on the, we'll do everything to make these people like us. You know, that's the model, right? We must make them like us. We include them in the schools, you know, as if nothing's different than when they're 18. Of course, the world is not inclusive. We dump them out and then you don't know what to do. But, well, you know, our model is we can help them. Let's make them as much like us as we can. We normals. We've got to help these people. Vanier's idea was, it's actually maybe been in university too long. I don't know, or hanging around important people too much. He said, I think actually being with them is better. For me, like I get more out of being with them than I do with being with the normals. So he wanted to create a community where the, what would you call it? The atmosphere of the house, or the valence of the house, or the charge of the house, or the spirit of the house, or the just the everyday kind of routine of the house came out of, not out of caring for them, but out of them and out of their living, as if they were equals who had a contribution to make, however subtle or strange that contribution might be. And you see, that's the history of intellectual disability, of disability, is to recognize these people as individuals with a contribution to make, as equals with a contribution to make, even though the contribution's hard to see or we might be unwilling to see it. So Vanier said, I want to reverse that. I'm going to hang around with them. And I did this, went to France for a time and lived in one of these places. And all I had to do was have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And everybody in the house eats together. They all sit around the table. Some of them cannot eat the food that's being cooked. It's good food. It's, you know, it's France. But they sit down anyway. Each person has an assistant. But that's all. And you go through the day.
So you just hung out there, in other words.
You hang out there. And I was petrified. And the first time I had lunch, I sat next to this guy whose name was Jean-Claude. He was my age. He was, I think he was 50. He has a mustache, a beard. He's in a wheelchair with a giant stuffed raccoon taped to the arm. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to have an entire lunch. He can't talk. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have an entire lunch with this guy? You know, I can't imagine anything worse, right? Because I'm thinking he's not right. He's not like me. He's not a complete human being. So we sit down and we say grace. You have to hold hands, right? And holding hands at a table with people, the hands of the disabled are like they're worth a book on their own, you know. And they're holding this. It's like holding two completely different roads, right? So we'd say the grace. I don't know what to say. I say ça va. You know, it's okay, Jean-Claude. Nothing, you know, a noise. There's a bottle of wine. He's 50. He's allowed to drink, you know. So would you like some wine? I pour some wine. And I think I pour some for myself. And I realize that Jean-Claude, he's semi-paralyzed, so he can't pick up the wine. So I said, I'll help you. So I pick up his wine and loop my arm into him. And I got my wine up to my mouth. And I say, ready? And he's got it's sort of a three-handed toast. I say, all right, a toast à trois mains, santé. And I pour his wine and pour mine at the same time. We sort of somehow get the wine down. And he goes, ha! Ha! And he's obviously totally there. He's like, it's a toast. It's a genuine toast. It's a toast with the body. And I thought, oh, this is how you do it. You don't have a plan. You go in and you have a good time if you can. You try and find a way to have a good. And you know, the thing is that we go in thinking, I've got to fix it, got to cure it, got to get rid of it, got to get it out of sight. They don't approach it that way. The disabled think, all they want is, oh, who are you? Do you like me? Do you want to be my friend? I think that's all they want is companionship.
Help me drink this glass of wine. So you're going with one idea of, well, some sort of, well, not even an idea, but a kind of a instinct of moral responsibility, which is really completely wrong.
Yeah.
In hearing about this then and talking with Jean Vanier, this inspired man, he's called the Martin Luther King of disabled people, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How close could you come to what he was putting to you?
He is religious. He believes, he says that he sees, when he looks at a disabled person, he sees the face of God in the face of that disabled child, because there is this person who says, no worries. Isn't that what you say in Australia?
Yeah, sure.
No worries. It's okay. It's okay. That's what they're saying. I don't see the face of God in Walker, and I cannot. But I do see the face of a human being. And I think that's enough. I hope it's enough anyway. I've talked to Vanier about it, and he says, you don't have to believe in, he says, if you were smarter, you might believe that God's involved in this. But he said, you don't have to. You have to trust them and yourself, and you have to trust that you have nothing to be ashamed of. You have nothing to hide, and you don't have to push anything out of sight. It is enough to be. You have a big career, a big radio show. You know what it's like. You were a performer, what that desperate desire to maybe get, maybe you don't know, maybe you were free of, to get ahead, to somehow measure up as a human being. You never succeed as a human, it always ends badly, right? We're all going in the same darkness. We came from that same darkness. But to be freed of that,
that's why we love babies so much, isn't it?
You've got a big baby.
Exactly. That's why we love them, because they don't have any of that.
Yeah.
They don't. And they have no superego. They have something that's very just, I suppose, I don't call it the nub of a human being, but the essence of a human being before some calculated social persona sort of forms around them.
Takes over. Yes, and I'm not suggesting that it's the only way to be. I mean, I'm a capitalist, and I believe in making money and having beautiful things and buying paintings and if I can. But it is an alternative way of doing things. And sometimes when I again and again these days, in the last year, I've heard more people say, I'm afraid the end of our time on this earth is coming. And I don't mean that, the apocalypse is coming, but that we've wrecked it. We've destroyed the oceans. The fish are disappearing. The air is bad. The global warming might be something more significant. One could make the argument that we have done that because we can't, we're addicted to thinking we know the answer, that we're addicted to using power to power through, to break, to hammer our way through. And I think one of the reasons why being with around Walker and why writing this book and trying to think about these things and just acknowledge them on the page, put them in a way that you could read without feeling ashamed or mawkish. A geneticist once called Walker, he said, he is a deleterious effect of nature. And that might be. But in terms of the ethical evolution of human beings, I would like to believe, anyway, that Walker and his kind might be a reminder of how we could improve. He might be a positive force for ethical evolution. Darwin said when he published The Origin of Species, people said, well, if survival of the fittest is what it's all about, why aren't the apes in charge? Because they are stronger and they are fittest. And Darwin said, because fitness is not the only definition of success. Human beings, Darwin believed, develop the ability to communicate, to talk, to have a conversation, to create the sort of public mind, right? Even if it's not present inside. Darwin said, we developed the ability to communicate because we were weak, because we needed to. So maybe that model of fragility is actually, could actually be strength. If we could forget about power and admit to our not trying to accomplish too much, just to be around and hang around and figure out a way to have a good time. Maybe we could approach the disintegrating Earth that way. Maybe it would be at least something to try along the way. And in that regard, maybe Walker and his kind are, as I said, a positive ethical step in our evolution.
So many big thoughts, large thoughts that
you're too big for my head, unfortunately.
No, but that's a really interesting idea that we've become powerful for a need to compensate for our physical fragility is a really interesting thought. And there are so many of them that come and keep coming to you, and your book is full of them, from a child who's at the level of 18 months old, who can't talk to you, not really, and whose mind you can't read, but only in the only in the vaguest sense. It begins with that central idea you mentioned right at the start, which is the question of, really, rather than idea, how valuable is Walker's life? Mm. How valuable is it? Because he's a child who has, I think you said, something like 20% of a life, really, and he's constrained your life right down to something, your wife's life and your daughter's life as well. That's a heavy weight, if you like, or a constraint. So have you got an answer? Do you have anything like an answer to how valuable Walker's life is?
When I look at Haley, who is, you know, as self-obsessed a teenager as a teenager can be, I said to her the other day, what do you want to do? And she said, I don't know, I'm torn, but I think I'd like to be a director. So, well, what are the alternatives? She said, well, I'd like to go to Africa and be a doctor. She went to Kenya at the age of 15. I see the effect he's had on her. And she's not a gentle soul who's helping out. She's she can be a sarcastic piece of work like any 17-year-old girl can. You know, and sometimes mean. She would never admit this, and she would be terribly embarrassed. I'm glad this is in Australia, because if she heard it in Canada, she would decapitate me when I went home tonight. But I think Walker has shown her that there are other ways of being, other ways of feeling, that you don't have to do it the orthodox way. You don't have to do what everybody else does. That Walker created a kind of a curtain. My wife used to call it the soundproof curtain. And it was isolating, but we got to make our own rules. And I think some of those rules were good ones. They were rules of compassion. And I think maybe Haley picked them up. I mean, that gives me some pleasure. I got to write this book. You know, as you were talking, I've just figured out why the ending of the book is the... And I won't give it away, but it was a harrowing moment when I thought maybe Walker was dying in my arms. And I realize now, I ended the book with, this is what it will be like if he dies. Because I was trying to realize what it would be like without him. I suddenly realized that Walker may not be much in life or look like much, but life without him would have been hollower. It would have not, I would never have got to this conversation, for instance, you know, to these speculative and possibly, I don't know, you know, like unslavish ideas, you know. So certainly he's been a great value to my life. I only hope I can... you know, do the same for him. And I'm not sure I can do as much.
Ian, this is a fascinating conversation. I've so enjoyed your company. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Likewise, completely.
Ian Brown, his book is called The Boy in the Moon.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.